I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. So, just real quickly, is Omar the one-eyed cheek really dead, or does he have more lives than Jimmy Hoffa, Jim?
Well, there's been rumors about him being ill. He's not that old, 60s, I think. But he hasn't been seen for years. I mean, he hasn't been seen in public for, three or four years. And that's, again, depending upon, secondhand testimony of people who said, I saw him that in Qaeda in Baluchistan, where he's been hiding out under Pakistani protection since 2002. The Pakistanis always denied that he was there. At the same time, they told the CIA that they can basically go after Islamic terrorists throughout the tribal territories, but not in Qaeda, which is the capital of Baluchistan. And we basically observed that request and been able to continue hunting down Islamic terrorists elsewhere in the tribal territories. But now, apparently because of the recent last few months agreement between Afghanistan and Pakistan and the United States, in effect, for intelligence sharing on terrorism matters and promises by Pakistan that they were really going to make it happen this time. Pakistan is infamous for their making deals and then instantly breaking them and not telling you that they're not following through. They apparently have said yes. He died 2 years ago. We kept it quiet because they wanted to keep it quiet. Taliban. Now, a lot of people are inclined to believe this because Omar should have been active in the peace negotiations that Karzai began. Now, peace negotiations were basically making deals with the Pushtun tribes. Pushtuns are about 40% of the Afghan population. There are twice as many of them in Pakistan, but Pakistan has a larger population. That's where the Taliban came from. The Taliban came from Pushtun tribes around Kandahar, down in heroin-producing territory. And a lot of these tribes had grown tired of their affiliation with the Taliban. They were, like most other tribes in Afghanistan, Pushtun and non-Pushtun, unhappy with the drugs that were leaking into the Afghan economy. It's one thing to export them and sell them to foreigners, but nobody's figured out a way to do that and not have some of them get sold fairly inexpensively to locals. So Afghanistan has over 2 million addicts of heroin, opium, what have you. And this is unpopular not for religious reasons so much as simply for social reasons. Basically, anybody gets addicted, and mostly it's men, but there are a lot of adult women, become a burden on their families, their clans. They are worthless. I mean, some people who are executed for crimes are basically hopeless, degenerate drug addicts, I believe is the term of art used in the United States, who are basically unwilling to kick the habit. And so this is a huge social problem in Afghanistan, as it is in Pakistan and throughout Central Asia. And of course, the tribes, tribal leaders could count. They noticed that only about 10% of the Afghan population, mostly Pushtuns, were making any money off of these drugs. Some of them were making a lot of money. Most of them were making a few extra bucks. It was a job, what the hell. But it wasn't really worth it if a couple of your cousins or your brother or your father, for that matter, had become a drug addict. So the government was willing to make a deal, kick the tribe, some of the foreign aid, some of the basically the corruption, withdraw security forces. I mean, these are the traditional deals a central government makes with the very independent-minded tribes of Afghanistan. They've been doing this for centuries. And Karzai, being a from a a high-ranking, wealthy, you know, Pushtun family in southern Afghanistan. He knew how to talk, and he was making progress. He was making deals. Now, a lot of foreign aid contributors considered these deals corrupt. He was just, you know, basically divvying up the foreign aid the government was stealing. But be that as it may, one by one, tribes or clans, powerful clans within tribes, were withdrawing their support for the Taliban. Now, this was important for the Taliban because it meant that they could no longer safely travel in the territory of these now hostile tribes. And this is where these stories started getting to about 3 years ago, you know, rural Afghans resisting the Taliban. Well, they were basically, you know, the only government they really paid attention to was the tribal government. And they were basically, you know, going along with the tribal leadership decision to no longer support the Taliban. And this is one reason why the number of dead civilians in Afghanistan has increased. I mean, it peaked in 2011 about 3,000, and it stayed that way. And of course, in 2014, it went up to nearly 4,000. A lot of that was basically the Taliban fighting with tribal groups that in the past would ignore them, would even help them, would they do business with them, they'd sell them, you know, weapons or food or what have you. And that was no longer the case. So, you know, they were wondering, you know, what does Omar have to say about this? Because he still has a lot of clout. Now, for the last, you know, since the last 14 years, he's been in exile, but he still has a say in appointing the front line commanders, you know, the guy who's running the Taliban in a portion of a province. There are dozens of these commanders. These guys have suffered a lot of attrition over the last 5 years, especially during the surge in 2010 and 2011. And they have developed different ways of thinking. A lot of them wanted to make peace. And basically they say, yeah, as a local Taliban leader, I make more money. You know, they even had a death benefits, scholarships for the leaders' kids, but they were getting killed off. So what was the point? This year, for example, well, last year, the Taliban lost about, the Taliban and Haqqani, you know, the various terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban in Afghanistan, lost about 6,000 men. They've lost that many the first half of this year. Now, the security forces are suffering heavy losses, but nothing like that. And, of course, the foreign forces are gone. So, you know, if you just look at the numbers, Omar, you know, must be going along, but nobody can get any word directly from Omar. They get it secondhand from his, you know, the curia, as it were, you know, his staff. And a lot of people apparently suspected that Omar was no more, or he was incapacitated. That was what the optimists thought. But now they're admitting, though, for the last 2 years he's been dead. Now, this is a huge blow to the Taliban. Omar was a sign of their prestige. He was a miracle maker, as it were, in the 1990s. He was the one that really put together, you know, what passed for a government, a Taliban government in the late 1990s. He's the one who made a deal with Al-Qaeda to allow Al-Qaeda to set up training camps, and in return, Al-Qaeda formed a special brigade, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 gunmen, a lot of them recent graduates of these training camps, and most of them non-Afghans. And these guys were sent around to discipline Pushtun tribes or any tribes for that matter, that were basically rebelling against Taliban rule. And of course that was good as far as Omar was concerned because these were not Afghans fighting Afghans. That's important because they have feuds in Afghanistan going back, you know, decades or even generations. They don't forget. But if it's a foreigner, he hates foreigners on general principle anyway. So it didn't make that much difference. Well, that all went poof. You know, after 9/11, by the end of 2001, it was all over for the Taliban government, and they fled into exile. And since then, they've been trying for over a decade to make a comeback. And the drug gangs, which have prospered, which actually prospered under Taliban rule, they were tolerated as long as they paid their taxes. They kept getting stronger. Business improved. And here they are promising all their people that your victory is coming in this year, and it isn't. And now they find out that their glorious leader, who has been, you know, basically untouched by the enemy, was laid low 2 years ago by some disease or whatever the hell it was. You know, hopefully that'll come out. Whether he's alive or dead is irrelevant, because he's been irrelevant for more than 2 years. And at this point, I suspect a lot of Taliban are going to say, the hell with Omar, the hell with Taliban high command, damn it, make a deal. I mean, this fighting the rest of the Afghans, which is basically what the Taliban is, you know, maybe 20%, they have the support of at most 20% of the Afghan population. They're fighting all the rest, and that's a losing proposition. That does not work. And they may be illiterate, most of them, but they know how to count. And they can count high enough to realize that it's a losing battle. So the death of Omar, whichever way it plays out, whether it's real or what have, or he's barely alive or whatever, I think that's broken a log jam, and we're going to see a lot more movement towards, you know, cutting deals with the government. You know, that won't necessarily put drug gangs out of business, but it's going to change the political landscape in southern Afghanistan.
Interesting. Well, Austin, let's move on to a different topic.
I got one thing I might say about Mullah Omar.
Okay.
He was a connector between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda respected him. I mean, there's he was offered deals to turn over senior Al-Qaeda leaders and report on where they were, and he refused. And the one thing that I would mention here is that it may be one of the reasons, and this is speculative here, but to show you where the speculation goes, the silence about his death is that some of the Al-Qaeda Taliban alliance, which is always iffy, becomes even iffier. And do you see some of the Al-Qaeda elements still operating in Pakistan, Afghanistan? Who knows? Do they give their loyalty to ISIL, Islamic State in Levant? That's one of the things. There'd be some fracturing. That actually fits in with what Jim says about making deals with the government in Afghanistan. But it has there's an international terror dimension to it.
So, Austin, let's talk a little bit about Turkey.
We're going to talk Turkey, okay?
We're going to talk Turkey.
Okay. All right.
It sounds like Turkey's decided to not wait for NATO or any of the other Western powers, and they're starting to get involved in the ISIL fight. What is going on there?
First of all, Dan, I'm hearing a lot of background coming across, so I will. You want me to respond about Turkey moving into Syria?
Right.
Look, NATO is very much involved in what Turkey's been doing. What you're seeing is Turkey take the lead and come through on some things that the Turkish government, as I framed it in my column this week, had been a bluff, and now they're going to execute the operation to create a buffer zone. Turkey started discussing buffer zones either in late 2011, certainly in 2012. I've got several stories in the spring, summer, and then fall of publicly mulling the utility of a buffer zone in northern Syria. One of the reasons at the time was to protect Syrian refugees who were streaming north and crossing the border, because they had examples of the Syrian government, the Assad regime, shooting refugees. And there were other elements in it as well. Turkey has always been concerned about Syrian Kurds providing bases for the PKK. Even though while this is going on, Dan, inside Turkey, there's the peace initiative between the government and the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK. But Turkey's been adamant that there will not be a separate Kurdish state ever, certainly not one on that shares a border with Turkey. So that element was even in play with the buffer zone. They were going to move Turkish troops into areas that were Syrian Kurd areas. All of this is before the rise of the Islamic State in Levant, before the rise of ISIL. Was NATO involved? Yes, to include moving German, Dutch, and American Patriot batteries into southern Turkey. Turkey asked for NATO support on that. Turkey and the United States, and possibly Great Britain, who was a leader here, were setting up intelligence operations in southern Turkey, inside Turkey, to monitor the situation in Syria. And when they're monitoring like that, the other things they're looking at is who they could work with on the ground, you know, the search for a Syrian democratic Syrian Syrian rebels that seem to constantly come to naught. So there's another alliance operation. Some logistical support for allied, not all of them NATO, but Australia has supplied the Kurds. That comes after ISIL makes its big move in 2014. But the indications are is that Turkey did had allowed logistical support to come through some of its air bases, and so there's more allied action. Turkey had also said that it was going to invoke NATO Article 5, which is we call the Three Musketeers Clause, one for all and all for one, because the Syrian government forces had fired across the border. Now, it was a very minor violation of territorial integrity. It really wasn't an outright invasion, and the threat from Ankara was one to tell the Syrian government, such as it was, don't do this. They also had the artillery shoot back at them and the like. I mean, the Turkish army fired back on some of the positions where the Syrian military had fired at the border or across the border. But that's an invocation of NATO. The United States had wanted Turkey to get more involved, even at Kobani. U.S., Turkish, whoever, forward air controllers or observers on the Turkish side helped control the coalition airstrikes, almost all of them U.S. Airstrikes, around Kobani when there was a fight between Syrian and Kurds and the Islamic State in the Levant guerrillas around that town. And eventually the Syrian Kurds prevailed. So what you have here is a very complicated situation of shaky coalitions, a strong alliance. NATO is a strong alliance. Uncertain relations inside Syria. Also, the Turkish demand that Assad, they blame Assad, and with good reason, for the conditions within Syria, and the Turks want him removed. The U.S. has said that we're for that, but the Turks interpreted the U.S. response as being very weak or very tepid because, you know, hey, if he's bad, but at least there's some sense of control, and look what we've got to deal with now with ISIL. So what happened was that there was a ISIL attack in a town in, I think it's Sanalura province. The name is Shurik, I think is the name of the town. I'm doing this off the top of my head. I don't have my column in front of it, but it's in the column. That's right. That's the name of the town. And some three dozen people were killed. Another 100 wounded. It was a suicide bomber. Evidence that even across the spectrum in Turkish media supports what the government says is that it happened to be a Turk who did it, but he was inspired by ISIL, and he was think of him as a lone wolf, that type of attack that we've seen elsewhere on ISIL's behalf. Except this was one they went after. This town is overwhelmingly Turkish Kurd, ethnically Kurd, and the town was being used as a rallying point for Turks raising money and providing support for the rebuilding of the town of Kobani. not all of the, you know, all the aid was coming from Kurds. Some of, they were collecting it there, and so they killed most of the dead. In fact, is all of the dead actually may have been ethnic Kurds. The second attack was smaller, and I'll say this, definitely more military. The Turks will call it, with good reason, a terror attack, but it was also the Kurdistan Workers' Party attributed to the PKK. Some PKK supporters indicated that, you know, it was probably a radical faction, attacked a Turkish army military position in a post and killed two soldiers. And what's now, this relates to the complex situation inside Turkey. Turkey doesn't have a government right now, Dan, and at least in parliament, there's all this negotiating to form a coalition government. Erdogan's Justice and Development Party didn't get an absolute majority. He's angry about that because he wanted to change the constitution to make him, the president, super powerful. What happened was that the new Kurdish ethnic party, the HDP, which means like People's Democratic, got 13 or 14% of the vote. So the Kurds became power brokers. The Republican People's Party did about the same as it always does. That's the Ataturk Nationalist Party. So there's been discussion about how to build a coalition government in parliament. But Erdogan was, according to everything I read in the Turkish press, in English, of course, but it's, he was stung personally, and he's blaming the Kurds, which is why you hear Turkish Kurds say what he's decided to do is scotch the entire peace initiative with the PKK and go after them and destroy them. And there's the rub inside NATO. NATO wants Turkey to take the lead in Syria, and has, and establish a buffer zone. Note that the United States says it's to be an ISIL-free, Islamic State-free zone. But the worry is that they're going to go in not just go after PKK support bases. Most of those actually are in the Kandil Mountains in Iraq, according to everything that I've read. But into Syria, and it's going to be an anti-Kurd Kurd strike. And that's why the NATO ministers, when Turkey called an Article 4 consultation, which is, as I said in the article, is basically a diplomatic show of force. It basically says, a nation that feels threatened, we've got big friends that got a lot of money and a lot of weapons. Well, that's what NATO's about. We often don't perceive that. We talk about how NATO's weak here and all that. It's still the most prestigious defensive alliance. It's the country club of defensive alliances, and it's a very serious one because you do have immense political, economic, and military power in the alliance. So Turkey called that. They got a political statement. But the NATO ambassadors did not. And all they said was, great, go after terrorists of all types. It didn't say go after ISIL or Kurds. They want them to go after ISIL. But the thing is that the NATO ambassadors overwhelmingly told Turkey. And this is what the coverage focuses on. Don't blow it with us and turn this into an anti-Kurd war. They're not going to say don't go after PKK factions that have bases in Turkey. I mean, bases in Syria. The Turks have free rein on that. And let me clarify the point I'm making there. The Kurdistan Workers Party was formed by a man named Apo Öcalan. He's been in prison in Turkey for a number of years. Öcalan decided, after initiatives from the government to participate in the peace process, there was a number, the majority of the PKK said, okay, we're going to follow the leader. But there were factions inside the PKK, as there are in every armed rebellion like that, that said, oh, you can't make a deal. The Turks are devils. And some of them issue press releases every so often, mostly from Kandil in Iraq, saying, you know, we won't participate in this, it's a fraud, whatever. You'll read in the Turkish press claims that, well, that's really the Turkish intelligence pretending to be PKK factions, but I discount that. These are hardcore guys, and they have at times thrown grenades and taken pot shots at Turkish security forces in southeastern Turkey to try to disrupt the process. Well, don't know for sure who launched the attack in July that killed the Turkish soldiers, but you go with probability, it's one of those factions. And so NATO's going to let the Turks do that, but they don't want a ethnic war, war on the Kurds, in part because the Kurds are bearing the brunt of the war against ISIL, particularly in Iraq. Complicated situation. Have I covered it? I hope so.
Yeah. Jim, your comments on Turkey and
that,
ISIL?
Yeah, a big problem that Turkey has with ISIL, which they, in effect, covertly supported initially because the Turkish government since, 2000 has been run by avowedly Islamic, politicians. Not, moderates by Western definitions, but definitely religious. And they saw a lot of Islamic radicals as allies, not as enemies. This is despite the fact that some of these Islamic radical groups had been making attacks in Turkey. And the Turkish government apparently thought they could make deals to make these attacks go away. At the same time, as Austin pointed out, 20% of the Turkish population are Kurds. Now, the Turks have always had a strange relationship with the Kurds. But they respect each other. I mean, the Kurds respect the Turks because they did come in and conquer the area. The Kurds have been there for thousands of years. The Kurds, only about 1,000 or so years ago wandered in from Central Asia. But they respect each other, much like the Iranians respect the Turks. They're tough. We couldn't conquer each other, et cetera, et cetera. The Kurds, however, like their cousins, the Iranians, are always split into factions which are fighting each other. The Turks have less of that problem. That's why the Turks developed an empire. Most empires come about because the people who are putting it together are willing to work together despite differences by various factions. Well, the Kurds have always been cursed by the factionalism. Now, the two main clans, factions in northern Iraq, made peace to a certain extent because the West were forcing them, especially the United States. Look, if you guys don't learn to work together, we're just going to walk away and you can go back to dealing with the Arabs and the Iranians and the Turks all by yourself. So they made peace. That is not permanent. But for the moment, it's holding, and there's been peace, prosperity in northern Iraq. But in Turkey, as Austin pointed out, Öcalan, the guy who started the PKK, declared for peace, and a lot of PKK members went along with that, but there are holdout factions which are basically out of his control, and these factions are not willing to admit that they're opposing factions. They haven't officially split. And again, this is the story of the Kurds going back thousands of years, the damn factionalism. Now, the problem in Syria is even worse. The PYD, which is basically, it's not really a Syrian branch of the PKK, but they're similar in politics and in methods, and they've worked together. Again, the factionalism. In other words, they work together because it's in their, both their interests. But as Austin points out, the Turks in Syria are the most effective anti-ISIL forces operating there. I mean, they marched on the ISIL capital of Raqqa, a provincial capital in eastern Syria, and they've been basically fighting outside that capital, not willing to go and hand that, street fighting yet. And they panicked the crap out of ISIL. I said, oh my God, we're talking about we're victorious everywhere, and here are these damn Kurds who we despise officially and unofficially, are right outside our capital, killing us right and left. Now, the PYD has the advantage of using that American air support by virtue of the fact that they are allied with the Kurds in northern Iraq, which is not PKK. Now, this is where it gets interesting. The northern Iraqi Kurds, when the Turks and the Americans declared this cooperative deal, and the Turks went back to war against the PKK, the northern Iraqi Kurds agreed with Turkey. Now, in part, this is because the PKK isn't easy to get along with. These are self-righteous revolutionaries, my way or the highway, you know, and of course, Kurds understand, even though we're all Kurds, we'll kill each other if we disagree enough. So you have, there's bad blood between the northern, the Iraqi Kurds and the PKK. The PKK, by the way, is the largest. There's about 15 million of them in Turkey. That's the largest group of Kurds in the Middle East. And they're split between pro-Turkish and pro-independence. You've now got the PKK and the Iraqi Kurds competing to get the Syrian Kurds to go one way or the other. Now, the Syrian Kurds are in a terrible situation. They depend on the Turks for support. I mean, if only to take their civilians, their families as refugees, and also to allow, and this caused a big public argument, you know, less than a year ago, when they were fighting, trying to defend Kobani, a Kurdish city in northern Syria, and the Turks wouldn't allow the Kurds from northern Iraq to send reinforcements. It took months of arm twisting and negotiations and Americans intervening, et cetera, before the Turks relented. And of course, the Kurds still accused the Turks of basically quietly allowing the ISIL to travel through Turkey to attack Kobani from the rear, which may or may not be true, but being in the Middle East, who the hell knows? But the bottom line is, the Turks are not sure whose side they're on. I mean, the reason why they joined this arrangement with the United States is because the United States has been pressuring them, as has the rest of NATO, for years to get on board. Islamic terrorists are bad news. I mean, and they point out that the Turkish government, which is Islamic, religious, is not the only Muslim majority government in the region, you know, run by people who are, you know, practicing Muslims, who are violently against Islamic terrorists of just all stripes. And of course, as Austin pointed out, the Islamist government of Turkey just lost, not absolutely, but they lost the majority in the recent election, so they're running scared. There's nothing like a frightening enemy and fear that your own organization is falling apart and the whole world is against you. You got a bad situation, in Syria, in Turkey, you know, and to a lesser extent, believe it or not, in Iraq. And in the middle of it all is the Kurds, who are considered the enemy by almost everyone concerned. But at the same time, for the Shia Arabs in Iraq and many of the majority of Syrians, they are the most effective fighters against ISIL. So what are you going to do? Apparently, Turkey's trying to do a little bit of everything, but it's going to be a while, months apparently, before the dust settles and we find out what Turkey is really up to. Because right now, no one knows. I don't think the Turks are sure.
Dan, let me make a couple of comments on the points that Jim brought up. First of all, the moderate Islamist Justice and Development Party, AKP, there's no doubt these guys are Islamist. They, compared to what you see in other quote-unquote Islamist governments, even ones taking very active, very, very active action against radical Islamist terror organizations. Compared to them, it really is a European-izing are extensively Europeanized Islamist government. I mean, the AKP tends to be more a free market liberal in the classic British sense, in the way the Europeans mean liberal economics, than some European parties. And they one other thing I'm comment on this too: Kurds belong to the AKP. They also belong to the CHP, the Republican People's Party, the old Ataturkish party. And as a matter of fact, the man who's currently head of the CHP is a Kurd. So that's, as Jim said, the relationship between Kurds and Turks, ethnic, okay, they're still Turkish citizens, is extremely complicated. And that also comes into what Jim said about Kurds being highly factionalized. You've got some who are, you know, support a moderate Islamist party, some that support a Turkish nationalist party, and the CHP is, and there are even some other fringe parties. So this Kurdish People's Democratic Party, which is a quote-unquote ethnic Kurd party, isn't the only party that Kurds belong to. But the point I was making about the Islamist government, to some degree, they tried to co-opt some of these groups in the way you hear President Obama talking about trying to talk to the Iranians and the like. Well, there was a little bit of that going on with the Turkish government, and you would assume, since the government's taking that tact, that the intel guys are out there looking around trying to say, can we make a deal with these groups? And this is before the ISIL makes its big move last year. And I kind of hinted at this. I say it in the column. That really changed a lot of things, Dan. The rise of ISIL, you know, the erasure of the Syrian-Iraqi border, and the invasion, you know, taking Mosul and the like. It shocked Turkey. It shocked NATO. Shocked the United States. Huge surprise, because one of the things, and I mentioned this in the column, one of the things is that both Turkey and the United States argued that major action might precipitate just a complete collapse inside Syria and incite ethno-sectarian bloodbaths. Well, you got one anyway. With ISIL. So that can explain some of the hesitancy, and why I say that Turkey had suggest that Turkey was playing with bluff, because powerful players can get some things by bluff. It's very hard to bluff radicals, though. ISIL and very desperate regimes like the Assad regime. So, just saying that the technique has real limits, which is why you have to move to force so often to deal with them. So, the complicated situation with the Kurds, very much there. The complicated but absolutely definite threat of ISIL changed, and the emerging threat and now definite threat of ISIL changed the calculation. Now, we don't have as Jim said, Turkey hasn't quite decided what it's going to do. I would say it's decided it's going to do. The question is, and what are all the goals where's its focus going to be on this buffer zone? You could see, and this is a scenario that NATO wants. What I'm about to say is a scenario that Paris, London, and Washington and Berlin would love, and that is that you actually have Turkish forces cooperating with Syrian Kurds in northern Syria to eradicate and eliminate ISIL's strongholds in eastern Syria, and then, in other words, cut ISIL and Iraq off from its bases. Now, that's a scenario, and I say that's the optimal scenario, and I have not seen anybody come out and say that, but I will bet that is what the prayer is in Washington. One other comment on the Kurds. Yeah, as Jim said, well, the Turks have been there about 1,000 years. Yeah, That's about right. 1,000 years, maybe 1,100, depending on which group of Turks coming in from Central Asia. And the Kurds have been there, well, they say, forever. A group, and I believe it's pronounced in Greek, Kiarde, shows up in Anabasis, Xenophon's, the retreat of the 10,000. The Kurds say that that's us. Xenophon reports that they were mercenary group was retreating across the Tigris and through what is now northern Iraq. They were attacked by these very fierce tribal fighters, and the Kurds say, "That's us. Hey, they didn't destroy the Greeks, but we took on Xenophon," and they're right. They were there. They have been there, and they were also promised. Under the Treaty of Sevres, which was supposed to settle the Ottoman issues, it was really part of the Versailles Treaties ending World War I. They were promised their own state. They didn't get one for a lot of reasons. Treaty of Lausanne supplanted it, and that was the Turkish nationalist response to the rise of Kemal Atatürk, Turkish nationalism, and the formation of the Turkish Republic. So the Kurds feel they've been cheated. They have legitimate reasons for feeling cheated. And I think I'll tell one little strategy page story since we're coming up on another anniversary. In my memory, this was about 5 emails, and I want to say it was like between 2000, maybe 2001 and 2003, and I don't have any of them anymore. But a Greek reader accused Strategy Page of favoring the Turks, and that was in our old Balkan section. And okay, not really. It just meant that the Turks had a case, and got one from a Turk who claimed that Strategy Page favored the Kurds. I just thought. I wish I'd kept them, but, you know, it was just the thing is that they were actually, as I recall, the Greek one was complimentary about somebody actually covering, you know, Balkan issues, even though there were plenty of them going on there because you had Serbia and Kosovo and everything like that. But okay, the thing is that I guess I'm giving us a little pat here. We try to balance it out, and I'll tell you, if anybody doesn't respect the Kurds and their Peshmerga organizations. They don't understand. They don't understand effective military organizations. The Kurds have done a lot with very little. I'm talking about the Kurdistan regional government in Iraq.
Right. Well, we're out of time, and we'll.
Jim doesn't have any comment there on that. He likes the Peshmerga.
I agree, and I have to go.
All right. We're out of here.
Okay. We'll talk to you next time,
guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.